Hello and welcome to the Obsolete Gamer Show. I am J.A. LaRock, and one of the things that I really love about science fiction is not just the idea of what looks impossible. Like, I love Star Trek, so the idea of flying across in ships and going, traveling, seeing aliens, things like that. But I also like the idea of what could be possible. I remember seeing in The Next Generation, they had the little tablets, and now we have something like that, today. So it's really awesome to see that kind of stuff. And that's kind of like what I'm seeing today with this film, Mind Games. And it's really interesting because you are mixing something that is science fiction based on real science. And it's really great to have Tim Mullen here today, who's a neuroscientist. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So the film, there's going to be an event on the 28th. And it's really cool because the film itself talks about the idea of merging minds together, where you can get motor skills, you can have like the skills of like Stephen Hawking and things like that. Now in the film they talk about how things can go wrong and things like that. But before we get into the film, can you talk a little bit about the science? Because I was reading about it and it sounds like really interesting. But me, I'm just a layman, so I'll go to the expert on it.
Yeah. So the film is fiction. It's a science fiction film, and we didn't have anything to do with the creation of the film, but it's I've seen it once before, and it's exploring certain fictional concepts around sharing mind skills. What could it be like? It's sort of set in kind of a alternate future. I mean, people will see it when they see the movie, but the concepts underlying it, the idea that someday we may be able to share motor skills or share an emotion or something like that. Those are real world concepts and real world ideas. And what's exciting when you think about some of those kinds of ideas is the potential for, improving function, for improving our capabilities, for having new experiences. That's what's really cool on the science side. Some of the things that researchers are looking at is how, with neuroscience and neurotechnology, we can enable these kinds of capabilities in people, even in the coming decades. And not to agree that we're talking about in terms of being able to have telepathy in the next 10 years or anything like that, but at a much, much cruder scale.
So what I was reading is that in the beginning they were starting with like mice being able to share information, where like one mice went through a maze and then they were able to teach the other mice to do that. Is that correct? How that happened?
Yeah. So there are actual experiments that have shown that ability to recording from one mouse to enable another mouse to be able to essentially use that same information that was learned by the first mouse. This is very early days for that kind of technology and that kind of science. And so there's still a lot more work needed until, something like that would work in a human. And we don't even know what that exactly would be like. But yes, some of these early things have been demonstrated.
So obviously there's going to be people that are like, wow, this sounds like something I could never possibly understand. One of the things they were talking about is the quantum computer, that you need to have that kind of computer power to be able to do that. What are like some of the other things that are like, I guess, taking the time, preventing us from being able to do that with humans?
Yeah. So, and this is where I say that the movie is fiction, because the way in which the movie represents it is using some kind of quantum technology, and that may or may that. Very likely will not be the way in which it actually works. But the basis is the idea that that new computing technology is needed to enable these kinds of capabilities. And this, quantum computers is one of the big breakthroughs in computing technology, the ability to have immense processing power. Similar kinds of, miniaturized nanotechnology, similar kinds of breakthroughs are what's needed to enable something like what we're describing to work.
Mm-hmm. Well, overall, even if it's just in the film, would you say that that's probably what it would take, like just computing power to be able to do, or is it more about still understand just the human brain? Like, how would that work to, like, imprint that kind of data? Because, obviously, I don't know that much, but, like, when you learn things, they say, like, how you learn things when you're a child, and then it gets harder, like, learning new languages and things like that. Is that one of the difficult things about teaching, like, an adult mind something brand new and having it stick and that person actually being able to apply it?
Yeah, the really challenging problem is that, one, we don't understand how information is represented in the brain. So this is part of what, as neuroscientists, we're trying to understand: what are the principles of brain function? What's the code, if you will, that the brain runs on? How does information come into the brain, get stored and represented, and then get translated into actions? And understanding that code is the first step. The other challenge is that everyone's brains are unique. They're different in various ways. The ways in which information is represented and stored is different. And so you need to develop technologies and capabilities that are able to adapt to those differences from one person to another, and then find some sort of shared representation, some way to kind of map between one person's way of storing information and another person's way of storing information. And that's a big challenge still. And there's a lot we need to know.
In the film, they talk about with the group that creates this technology, connecting people, and it sounds like a great idea. And then, of course, they have like the bad thing that goes wrong. Now, that's the science fiction part of it. But obviously, someone's going to ask the question of, hey, if we're able to do this for real, then couldn't, I guess, a negative thing be brought from it? Like, could negative skills be put into someone's mind, theoretically?
So, you know, the reality is that with all technology, there's all from, you know, Niels Bohr and the atom leading to the atomic bomb, you know, and also leading to technology that cures cancer and that, you know, saves lives every day and that, you know, ultimately will, you know, get us to the stars probably. These kinds of outcomes, you know, are one, there's always two sides to any technology. The way that humanity can use things for good and to empower and to move us forward to something greater and better than what we are. And the tendency for humans to sometimes take things down the wrong path. Now, the film, of course, is a fictional representation, and it's not, you know, the way in which things are represented there are nowhere near how humans are using the technology now. And the ways in which it's represented are not the way, even really necessarily realistic outcomes in terms of how you would use it. But that being said, we do always have to be conscious of this fact. And, you know, our real responsibility as scientists and technologists is to think about that and think about, you know, how we can use the tech for good. Society also has to always think about this. But, you know, in the film, it's interesting because I remember now that the film, they're really battle against these dark forces, but ultimately to realize the technology's true potential for good. So, you know, anyway, you know, I don't want to like give things away, but there's always a, you know, there's a nuanced view on it. And so while things may look dark, the reality is that there's, you know, it's towards a bright outcome. And I think that's what's fun about being able to explore these ideas in science fiction.
Now, I remember back in the day they used to talk about how we only use 10% of the brain, and they said, no, that's not true. Would there be a limit, like, in just the research and the information that you have of, like, how much you could learn? Because, like, if someone, let's say, they have just normal intelligence, and then you want to be able to theoretically teach them something that's really difficult and complex, could you, like, overload the brain, or do we have the capacity to learn, like, almost infinite?
I wouldn't say infinite, but the information storage capacity of the brain is immense. I mean, so if you think about it, the amount of information that you're absorbing every day, that alone is immense. It's a huge amount of information. But in addition, you've got memory, you've got all the historical information that you've accessed over your entire lifespan. That's all stored in the brain. It doesn't disappear. Everything that your brain perceives is stored somewhere, but the way in which it can be accessed still and worked on That's the challenge. I mean, memory, you forget, and there's a reason for that. And I won't go into the details, but you know, that for, there's computational reasons why that likely happens. But the brain has the capability, we think, for storing all this information and being able to access and represent it in some way. And when you think about that, that's more than any computer that we know of in terms of the capabilities, you know, greater than any computer that we know of, or really that we have the capability of building in the near future. Now, there are limits, of course. There are limits to information processing in the brain. And one of the interesting questions is it possible for us to surpass those limitations with technology? Is it possible for us to augment the brain so that we can have superintelligence, so that we can have infinite memory, so that you can connect your thinking, your reasoning systems with, say, the cloud, where you could access all of Wikipedia's knowledge in, you know, moments. And now when you have that capability to go outside the cortex, the thin little, the neocortex, the little recent evolutionary portion of the portion of the brain that's recently evolved, that really separates us from, you know, from our nearest primate neighbors. When you have the ability to take that part of the brain and then connect it up, and I don't mean like wire it in, but I mean have information transmitted between that and, say, supercomputers in the cloud, what would that allow us to do? That could enable us to have limitless capabilities, because we can limitlessly, you know, expand our computing capabilities out there, whereas the cortex is, you know, it does have its limitations.
I remember another science fiction show that I saw once, society was able to just access information in a moment. I think it was like an Outer Limits or something like that.
Yeah.
And they were able to access it. And then there was one person that, for whatever reason, he could not access it. And they considered him like dumb or something like that. But he read and he would study and write, which everyone else would just touch their head and they learned everything. When something happened with the system, they weren't able to retain it. They weren't able to do it anymore. And then he had to actually teach them to read at the end.
Now, I think, I've seen that before.
I really love that idea. So, I mean, as a scientist, I mean, you deal in fact and science. Is it possible that if you could connect yourself to a cloud and learn all this information, could it have the effect of maybe what happens with cell phones, where when I was younger, I remembered my friend's phone number by heart, the address, and now it's like, oh, I have to check my phone. Could that happen with the knowledge you obtain from a cloud-based system like that?
Yeah, so I mean, so think about it this way. Like, 30,000 years ago, when we didn't have some of the evolutionary, the layers of our brain that have given us advanced reasoning capabilities now, you know, that was like version 1.0. Now we're at version 2.0. And you imagine that if we didn't have that capability, if we didn't have the ability for sort of abstract reasoning, for, you know, being able to imagine that you didn't have the ability to reason about the future in the complex way, like to imagine a future of thousands of years from now, okay, and put yourself there in your mind, and you didn't have that ability. You know, if all humans had that and suddenly it was gone in an instant, right, we wouldn't have societies that we have now. We wouldn't have any of the capabilities that we have now. The same thing would be true of our future selves. You know, hundreds of years from now, if we have augmented and changed ourselves in some way, and we're connected to other digital systems, and we essentially are superhuman in some sense. If that was gone in an instant, yes, it would be disruptive for sure. It would change our society. Would we be able to adapt to that? Well, in the movie, in that show you talked about, you saw how, you know, someone figured it out how to, you know, teach everyone everything again. Humans are adaptable. We would survive. We would figure out how to relearn again. And so, you know, I don't see it as being something that would be calamitous. But yes, it would have an impact, of course.
So on March 28th, it's not only an event where people can go see the film, but you're also conducting, an experiment about having all those people have a shared experience. Could you tell us a little bit about what will be happening for the people that attend that event on March 28th?
Yeah, so the event on March 28th, it's really a unique experience for people. It's a neuroscience experience. They get to have access there to wearable sensors and cloud technology that's going to allow them to sort of take part in this first attempt. No one's ever really tried this before, to create a dynamic visualization of brain activity from 1,000 people engage in a shared experience. And, you know, this is going to be broadcast in real time to other audience members around the nation. But, 1,000 people in New York and in LA are going to together create this, this representation of all of their brain activity in motion. And we don't know what's going to happen. You know, we don't know if it will work. We, you know, this is first time to sort of see this, but that's part of the process of going out on sort of a limb of exploration and a spirit of exploration, going out on a limb and seeing what's going to happen from that. And then on the research side, what's interesting about this is that we've never really had an opportunity to look at from a scientific perspective how cognition works in large numbers of people all experiencing the same thing together. What's happening in their brains? What's happening in your mind? And how does that relate to other aspects of sort of who you are, like, you know, your creative style or your age? You know, are all the people from 18 to 25, do they all tend to show kind of the same patterns of brain activity, you know, relative to people who are 45 to 60? You know, do people who are creative extroverts show kind of similar brain patterns than people who are, you know, maybe risk takers or, you know, so this is what we're going to try to look at by taking little questionnaires. It's totally anonymous. No, you know, there's no, nobody will know who you are or anything, but little questionnaires you'll take in advance. And then we're going to try to explore this and hopefully show you some really cool insights into that right there, you know, after the movie. So.
Yeah, the idea about that is really fascinating to me because I remember them talking about just, you know, very simple concepts like if you hear someone laugh, you want to laugh. It, you know, if you're in a group together, people are clapping, you don't even necessarily have to put on a little sign saying applaud. Other people will think to applaud. Is that just one of those things, like maybe I guess on the basic end, where you just see when a bunch of people get together, they'll react, but in their mind, different things may be going on, even if maybe physically they just copy what other humans are doing at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. This is also one of the interesting questions is, how much of that is driven, how much of that brain activity, that response is driven by the people around you versus the thing you're experiencing. So, you know, when everyone starts kind of laughing or they shift their posture, or they move in some way, is that what makes me respond in a similar way? Or is it the thing that we're seeing, you know, the movie, you know, on the screen or the, you know, the common shared experience that makes us act that way? So we actually have, since we have people in two different locations, we can actually even explore that. I mean, we won't necessarily, we may be able to explore that live in real time, but there's also research that we'll be able to do after this movie. That's really where a lot of the really interesting research is going to happen is after the event, you know, after the March 28th. But one of the things is we have two locations, so we can look at people, how not only similarities in one location, so you and all the people that you are nearby, we can say, oh, were you more similar to each other than any one of you and anyone in another location, like in New York, you know? And if you're just as similar in your brain response as somebody in LA as somebody in New York, right, then we can say, oh, okay, well, what's happening there is that the changes in your brain activity are being driven by the film and not so much by those things like, you know, the people around me and how they're sitting and how they're moving and if they're laughing or not. You know, that's not really driving the effect. So that's one of the things that we'll be able to look at. Yeah.
That is very cool. The game is, the film is Mindbenders, and it's going to be in theaters in the U.S. on March 28th. I want to thank you, Tim, for coming on and talking about the science behind it.
Yeah, thanks. It's good to talk to you.